Welcome to Holden Village. Today in the fabulous fireside room, today's speaker is Patty Mueller. She's speaking on wolves, a howling in the wilderness. So let's listen in on Patty.
My name is Patty Mueller, and this week I'm leading a series of sessions that kind of explore our relationship to the wilderness, and that's kind of a fancy way to say that quite a few of my sessions will just be out exploring the wilds and doing different activities out and about. And all of the hikes that I'm doing and leading as the week goes on here, this is going to be all inside, but the hikes that I'll be doing will all be pretty much on the level. I'm not this week taking out any hikes out into the mountains maybe, but not up. So those of you that may be interested in going on some of those, they're out on the kiosk explaining those. Need not worry about anything terribly exhausting. It'll be pretty slow, a lot of interpretive walking and such. So looking forward to perhaps seeing some of you on those as the week goes on. But today I'm beginning with a program on the wolf, which I think is very appropriate in a series involving the wilderness, because the wolf to many people is a true symbol of the wilderness and wild places. And before I even really get into that, I realize that today is Thoreau's birthday. He was born in 1819, so I thought I'd start out at the very beginning with one of his quotes that I'm sure all of you have probably heard, and that is, "In wildness is the salvation of the world." So I'd like to share quite a few different things with you here today. Most of the program is going to be slides, and I have gotten all of my education and training on the wolf in Minnesota. And probably not many people know that Minnesota actually is the state that has the largest population of wolves in the lower 48 states. We can't compete with Alaska. I don't know that any state could in many things. Such a big state up there. I was fortunate enough to work up there too, not on the wolves, but on some other critters when I was in wildlife biology. But Minnesota has the largest population of wolves in the lower 48 states. We have about 1,700 wolves, and they're all concentrated up in northeastern Minnesota, although they're comfortably and slowly moving their way down to within an hour and a half of the metropolitan area of Minneapolis and St. Paul. So they're doing quite well in northeastern Minnesota, but that's where I received my training with a wolf biologist named Dr. Dave Meach, who is a world-renowned wolf biologist doing studies all over the world, but concentrated certainly in Minnesota and Alaska. The relationship between people and wolves is a very complex relationship, and it involves a very wide range of emotions and attitudes and thoughts. And I would like to share with you a reading from Aldo Leopold. I don't know how many of you are familiar with him. He is a conservationist. He worked for the United States Forest Service. He worked for the Forest Service in the early part of the 1900s. He passed away in 1948. And so all of his writings, all of his ideas took place during the early part of the century, which I find fascinating because the kinds of things I'm reading from him are things that could have been written today as far as what is going on today too. But he, in his work, in his early career, the attitude towards any kind of a predator was to get rid of the predator. Predator control. That was what game management was. And that is why organizations like the Forest Service, a main reason they existed was to provide resources for people. And one of those resources was game for hunting. And so predator control and not meeting predator extermination really is what predator control meant. To get rid of the predators was the only way you're going to have enough game to have good hunting, and on and on and on. So Aldo Leopold firmly believed in that in the early part of his career. And what I'm going to read for you right now is a situation and experience that happened to Aldo Leopold that changed his view on how to manage the prey and changed his view on wolves. And it's called Thinking Like a Mountain. Very appropriate here as we're surrounded by mountains at Holden. So Thinking Like a Mountain. A deep, chesty howl echoes from rimrock to rimrock, rolls down the mountain and fades into the far blackness of the night. It is an outburst of wild, defiant sorrow and of contempt for all the adversities of the world. Every living thing, and perhaps many a dead one as well, pays heed to that howl. To the deer, it is a reminder of the way of all flesh. To the pine, a forecast of midnight scuffles and of blood upon the snow. To the coyote, a promise of gleanings to come. To the cowman, a threat of red ink at the bank. To the hunter, a challenge of fang against bullet. Yet behind these obvious and immediate hopes and fears, there lies a deeper meaning, known only to the mountain itself. Only the mountain has lived long enough to listen objectively to the howl of the wolf. Those unable to decipher the hidden meaning know nevertheless that it is there, for it is felt in all wolf country and distinguishes that country from all other land. It tingles in the spine of all who hear wolves by night or who scan their tracks by day. Even without sight or sound of wolf, it is implicit in 100 small events: the midnight whinny of a pack horse, the rattle of rolling rocks, the bound of a fleeing deer, the way shadows lie under the spruces. Only the uneducated can fail to sense the presence or absence of wolves, or the fact that mountains have a secret opinion about them. My own conviction on this score dates from the day I saw a wolf die. We were eating lunch on a high rim rock at the foot of which a turbulent river elbowed its way. We saw what we thought was a doe fording the current, her breast awash in white water. When she climbed the bank toward us and shook out her tail, we realized our error. It was a wolf. A half dozen others, evidently grown pups, sprang from the willows and all joined in a welcoming party of wagging tails and playful maulings. What was literally a pile of wolves writhed and tumbled in the center of an open flat at the foot of our rimrock. In those days, we had never heard of passing up a chance to kill a wolf. In a second, we were pumping lead into the pack, but with more excitement than accuracy. When our rifles were empty, the old wolf was down and a pup was dragging a leg into impassable slide rocks. We reached the old wolf in time to watch a fierce green fire dying in her eyes. I realized then, and have known ever since, that there was something new to me in those eyes, something known only to her and to the mountain. I was young then and full of trigger itch. I thought that because fewer wolves meant more deer, that no wolves would mean hunter's paradise. But after seeing the green fire die, I sensed that neither the wolf nor the mountain agreed with such a view. From that time on, Aldo Leopold, began to advocate the importance of predators. And he really is considered the father of all game management, and he developed this land ethic that basically talked about what we're all familiar with now, about every little tiny thing being important to the whole, and anytime you disrupt one tiny part of the environment, you are in some way disrupting a web of life, and the whole is not the same as it was before. So that was over 50 years ago that Aldo Leopold began that new viewpoint and wrote about it and spoke about it and taught about it. He taught at the University of Wisconsin in Madison and just certainly became common knowledge. But 50 years have passed and there are still people who hate the wolf and who don't want to pass up an opportunity to kill a wolf, even though it's quite illegal. It's as legal as it can get, because luckily for the wolves, in 1974, they were protected governmentally, which is, again, such a turnaround from before that when the government paid money to people to kill them. So it's just an incredible amount of and variety in people's responses and attitudes and things towards the wolf. Well, I would like to, with that as just kind of laying a background, I would like to share with you the facts about the wolf, just the kind of the objective facts about the wolf that have been gleaned from wolf research. Because the organization I work for, the International Wolf Center, was established about 5 years ago simply to educate people objectively about the wolf so that the hate that some people feel, or the fear that many people feel, at least a little bit of fear if they imagine themselves in wolf country alone at night in the middle of nowhere hearing a wolf howl, there's at least a tingle up the spine and kind of a little bit of an emotion there that could be perhaps linked to fear. The Wolf Center hopes that through programs like this, people will have a more objective idea about the wolf and more facts about the wolf, so that perhaps that certainly the fear and perhaps some of the hatred would be dispelled about the wolf. It seems the main misconceptions about wolves revolve in a couple of areas. One is that they can be of harm to people. Has anyone ever heard anything that would lend to that attitude? Anyone ever heard anyone talk or any story or anything at all that would paint the wolf to be an animal that could potentially hurt a person?
Well, persons self or a possession.
Pardon?
Persons self.
The people. People. Yeah, not possessions, no people. People themselves.
Little pigs.
Little Red, yeah, all the fairy tales.
Yeah.
Yeah. Little Red Riding Hood, Three Little Pigs. Definitely. Who has not heard the story of Little Red Riding Hood? Now, being adults now, and certainly knowing that that is but a story, who doesn't still have pictures in your mind, somewhere in your subconscious, that paint the wolf out to be evil?
Well, there were some movies where they had wolf packs attack
people. Oh, sure. Yeah, the media. There are movies nowadays that aren't, you know, paint the wolf in a little bit of a different light, but there's certainly movies. Werewolves. Have wolf definitely associated very strongly with evil. Very much of the early church would have the wolf be a symbol for Satan and evil. So yeah, our history generally does not paint the wolf in a good light. So it only makes sense because of that background, because of the history, because of our traditions, our folklore, our legends, that we would not consider the wolf a cute and cuddly companion type of an animal. It's certainly a symbol of the wilderness, but it's also one of fear, of some evil, of the unknown, those kinds of things. So that's one big misconception, that wolves do hurt people. And as far as the facts go, there's never been a case in North America where a wolf has killed a person. It just has never happened. And that's a fact. Now, you could have seen headlines saying wolf kills child, and unfortunately it has happened that people that have had wolves for pets, wolf hybrids, which would be a wolf dog cross, they have killed small children, and I don't know the number, but I know it's happened several times, certainly more than once, which is too many times, of course. So that would potentially give the wild wolf a bad name, but that's no wild wolf has ever killed a person in North America. And again, back in the Middle Ages in Europe, wolves killed people. It was associated with the plague and just the awful conditions with dead bodies out everywhere because of the plague, and wolves feeding on those and then attacking live people, and just, it was, you know, awful, obviously just a horrendous time, and perhaps a lot of the folklore arose from some of those kinds of situations. But again, here in North America, which most of us spend most of our time and where we're trying to reintroduce wolves in some areas, it has never happened that they have hurt a person. The second area would be that they can harm deer herds, and there's not going to be enough deer and other game animals for hunters. That's another big concern. And that goes back to kind of Aldo Leopold and some of his writings. And just in reading the section that I read, it goes on and on to talk about how the wolf actually helps the deer population be strong and healthy. And we'll talk more about that in the slides. Not to say that a wolf won't take the strongest, healthiest buck in the herd if he can get it, but they tend to take what's easier to get. So the attitude that the wolf is bad because it kills other animals. I've given many of these programs, and I was teaching an elder hostel and had a very interesting experience that really made me realize how strong people feel about the wolf and how negative some of those attitudes can be. And the sweetest, sweetest woman, an older woman, she happened to be a nun, had a great love for the earth and God's creation, and just the sweetest person. She came to my wolf program and just was so angry and so upset and so aghast that I could even consider having any positive feelings toward the wolf, because they killed deer. They killed deer. I mean, it was so awful in her mind that anything would kill such a beautiful, wonderful, lovely animal as deer. And I call that the Bambi syndrome. And I certainly can see deer are beautiful creatures. I mean, the one I would be sad in my heart to see a wolf come in here and kill one of those sweet little fawns that are grazing right outside our chalets. It would be callous to say that, oh, that's just how nature works, no big deal. I mean, there's a sadness, but there's also looking at the larger whole of how the world works. So that is another reason, though, why people have that negative feeling. And I always like to mention to those of us that eat meat at any time in our lives that we're really doing the same thing. We're eating to live, and what we happen to eat at one time also lived, but that's a part of the great circle of things. So, well, I think I'd like to go with the slides, and hopefully we'll have a little bit of time to go over some of the things that I brought here too, and I have some howling that I'd like to share with you too at the end. But let's show some slides. I'm going to get the lights here. We want to hit the window there. If someone wants to reach to turn on the slides, hey, you're real close. If you want to click that back button all the way to high. Here, I can help. It's in the back, I believe. All projectors or something. There we go. Are people able to hear me okay? I have a mic here, so maybe just to make it easier with the slides, I can use it. No. Is there a separate light that turns that one off, I suppose? You seeing okay?
Yeah.
All right, great. As I talked about in the beginning here, the folklore is very responsible for people's attitudes towards wolf. The Little Red Riding Hood story is the first one that was mentioned, and is very much in people's minds when they think about the wolf. Different cultures, though, the Native Americans here in this slide hold the wolf in very high regard. These are two Native Americans under a wolf pelt. They held the wolf in very high regard because they also were hunters, and they were that is how they survived. And the wolf was such an incredibly excellent hunter, they wanted to emulate the wolf, to become more like the wolf. So the wolf was an animal that was very respected in a Native American culture. Many people do not get the opportunity to see the wolf or even hear the wolf. The howl of the wolf, as I mentioned in the very beginning, the wolf itself is very much a symbol of wilderness, and the howl of the wolf, to me, makes a wilderness area that much more complete and that much more feeling of a wilderness experience. The wolf itself is a fascinating animal, very well adapted to its life as a predator, to its life in a wilderness area. Wolves range in size anywhere from 60 to 80, 90 pounds. In Alaska, they'll get to be 125 pounds or more. So they're a pretty big animal. They're about 6 feet from the tip of their nose to the tip of their tail. They have excellent eyesight, smelling, and hearing. They're said to be able to hear a mouse as it moves underneath the snow. Their fur is another thing that is very incredible. They live in the northern hemisphere, so many areas they live in where it gets very, very cold in the winter. Northern Minnesota, I'm sure, has quite the reputation. You're all aware that it gets cold there. 40 below is common for a stretch of time, especially in January. But this wolf, it could be 40 below and he's panting because he's warm, very warm. They have several adaptations that allows them to be warm. One is just in the fur. They have two layers of fur, a very thick under fur that is almost impossible to penetrate with your fingers. It's a couple inches thick and just very, very dense. And then the outer layer of guard hairs that act as almost a raincoat. They shed water and rain to keep the under fur dry and thus keep it warm. And the pads of their feet actually regulate temperatures separate from the rest of their body. So they can be walking on this frozen snow, but a lot of heat is not going to escape because the temperature of the pad of the foot is just above freezing. So that's another thing that really helps them. Now, like many animals, they cannot sweat. So when they are warm, they pant like this animal here does. Another interesting thing about the wolf, and Aldo Leopold related it in his little writing here too, is that many people do confuse them with a deer at first sight because their legs are so long in proportion to their body, much more so than a dog would be. Very long legs, very narrow chested, enabling them to really run, especially in a densely forested area, to maneuver and to move through. There are over 32 different subspecies of the wolf found throughout the world. There are whole Arctic species, or species found in the northern hemisphere. And this particular slide here is showing the Arctic wolf. The Arctic wolf lives in an area where tundra, basically, no trees, and its coloration is allowing it to better blend into its surroundings. This is the wolf that David Meach studied quite a bit for the last several years. In the summer, he'd go up there, and he would camp within 300 yards of their den and would have the pups actually come over and play with his shoelaces on his boot and such. They don't have the fear of people that the wolves farther south in like the lower 48 states in Alaska might have. Wolves come in a variety of color variations. The gray wolf is probably the most commonly thought of wolf, but black, white, different colors are also found. I don't know if any of you are from the southeastern United States at all here. The red wolf was native to that area, the southeastern United States, but was completely taken from the wild. And luckily, though, there were still some animals in zoos, and a captive breeding program began, and they are now reintroducing the red wolves to the southeastern United States. The Alligator River National Wildlife Refuge is one area where they're reintroducing the wolf, and it's going pretty successfully. The idea of reintroducing wolves is a very hot issue right now. They're in the last stages, actually, of trying to reintroduce them to Yellowstone National Park, and it looks like an experimental population of wolves will be reintroduced there. An experimental population, that designation means that the wolves could be killed if they're causing any kind of trouble, especially if they would get out of the park. Whereas if they reintroduce themselves coming down the Northern Rockies, which some are doing, not getting as far as Yellowstone yet, but some are doing, if they reintroduce themselves, they would have the protection of an endangered species, which would mean no one could kill them no matter what kind of a deal. So the ranchers kind of like the idea of an experimental population. They're much more comfortable with that. And it's really all politics when it comes to trying to reintroduce wolves. You've got to make as many people as possible happy with what you're doing, or you're not going to have them there, or you're not going to have them stay alive for very long. The Cocker Spaniels in the slideshow here are, as with all dog breeds, are ancestors of the wolf. Over 13,000 years ago, the first wolves were thought to be domesticated, and through quite the extensive breeding programs, you get all the different kinds of dog breeds we have today. The taxonomists have just change their grouping of the dogs and now consider them more closely related to the wolves, basically. That the dog is now another subspecies of the wolf, technically. So the Europeans have always looked at it that way, but now in America they're also kind of fooled around with just the naming. I mean, we're just talking about names here, but it's interesting. Some people think the Malamute or the German Shepherd or some of those animals that look more like a wolf actually are more like a wolf. It's just that they were bred for certain characteristics that just happen to look more wolf-like. The Chihuahua, the Poodle, those are just as closely related to the wolf. The coyote is another animal that gets often confused with the wolf, but there's quite a few differences, one of which is the coyote is extremely adaptable and can live near people. I've heard of coyotes walking down main streets of fairly large towns and cities even, and I know they live within a stone's throw of many metropolitan areas. Anytime you have a nice river bottom that's forested, you could potentially have coyotes there. So they adapt to people quite well. Wolves do not and have not been able to adapt that way. There's also quite a bit of difference just in the natural history. The coyote is maybe 20 or 30 pounds, a third of the size of a wolf. They do not live in packs, which I will go into in quite detail about the wolf. That's one of the signatures of the wolf, is that it lives in a pack. They, because of that, then hunt the smaller rodents, rabbits, those kinds of things. The howl of a coyote could certainly be confused with that of a wolf. So some people think they're hearing wolves when they're actually hearing coyotes. But if you actually see the animal, it's pretty obvious. Their ears are bigger, their nose is pointier. So if you actually are having a chance at looking at the animal, it's pretty easy. And you can just go by range. There's wolves almost nowhere, there's coyotes almost everywhere. And we'll talk more about the range in a moment. Here, our Latin lesson for the day, those of you that have gone to seminary and know your Latin. Basically, this is just showing you the original range of the wolf, the different subspecies of the wolf. All the different colors are simply different subspecies, but the point of the slide really is to show you that wolves originally were found everywhere. And that, to me, is amazing, that the same animal can live in a desert, can live up in the alpine, in the mountains, can live in the prairies, can live in the eastern forests, the western forests, the tundra. Incredibly adaptable animal as far as the habitat situation. Not as far as coexisting with civilization, but as far as being able to live in a variety of habitats, incredibly adaptable. Now, all that white means no wolves. So this is our situation today, the current range of the wolf. You can see that you still have them up where there just aren't that many people. Up in Canada and up in Alaska, there's, oh boy, at least 6,000 wolves in Alaska. And wolves are considered a game animal in Alaska, and there's a lot of controversy with wolves in Alaska too, which I'd be happy to chat with anyone who's interested in that. And there's still a few down in Mexico, but you can see the lower 48 states is pretty darn much empty. Here showing the lower 48, Minnesota, my home state, which I'm quite proud. We have 1,700 wolves, as I mentioned, and the wolves from Minnesota have gone to repopulate Wisconsin. They had been completely wiped out in Wisconsin. We have like 70-some wolves now in Wisconsin. Isle Royale out in Lake Superior has about a dozen wolves. You can see up in, now going out west, there are some wolves in Glacier National Park, and wolves are actually starting to come down the northern Rocky Mountains and repopulate themselves. And I often like to think of the wolves as kind of defying the political system, because in Washington, D.C., they are arguing up a blue streak, and have been for many, many years, about should we reintroduce wolves out west or not. The western senators, you know, have the ranchers really lobbying them to not introduce, not reintroduce, but the wolves are slowly doing it themselves. So they're not paying any attention to what's happening down in Washington. So I don't know that they'll get all the way down to Yellowstone, as I mentioned, but you never know. You can never underestimate the power of a wild creature, I think.
Is that true in the Cascades as well?
In the Cascades, the situation, I was talking to the rangers so that I could get some real accurate information. They have verified not specific sightings, but sign of wolf. Howling, tracks, they believe they might even have a den site. There have been sightings. I just don't know how verified the sightings are, but they believe there are some wolves up in La Ross Lake area of the North Cascades is where they've been sighted. But again, I know how the wolf works and how far and fast it can move. There could be wolves within 15 miles of here very easily at any one time, and then 3 days later they could not be there. They just can really move around, especially lone wolves. As far as the pack goes, they tend to stay within a 10-mile square area. But a lone wolf could be dispersing all over the place, just trying to find the right place. They certainly would have enough food to eat here, so it's certainly a place that they could live. But there are some wolves in Washington, in the North Cascades specifically. The reason, of course, that the wolves aren't where they used to be is persecution. The policy up until the 70s was to get rid of wolves. They were truly thought to be a public nuisance for farmers and ranchers and just for people in general. The idea of Little Red Riding Hood, though not by name, but certainly by kind of the attitude, the gist of things was that wolves were not good to have around people, so you could make money. And during the Depression, of course, this was great. You could make money by killing wolves, even the pups, going in the den and getting the pups $10 a pup, or it varied. But you could make a decent living, certainly could feed your family by doing wolf extermination. So trapping, poisoning, shooting, all kinds of methods to get rid of wolves. It's really ironic when you think of the history of wolf persecution and realize that the last wolf in Yellowstone National Park was shot by a ranger in 1926, the last known wolf. And you have to say the last known wolf because it is so hard, it's such a big place to know if a few survived here or there. But the last known wolf was shot by a ranger in 1926, and now they're trying to reintroduce them there. So things change, certainly. The wolf lives in a pack, and really, if you're comparing human society and wolf society, there's a lot of similarities. The pack is a very strong family unit that truly works together and is very highly organized in order to survive. The pack is made up of an adult pair that's called an alpha pair. There's an alpha male and an alpha female. Within the pack, there's a dominance hierarchy in both the males and the females within the pack. The pack generally is made up of the offspring from the alpha pair, and they have one litter of pups a year. So they might have the yearlings and then the pups from the current year. But there are also other wolves that could have been brought into the pack that are not related to the pack. So that does happen, but mainly you're having this family group. The alpha male and the female, as I said, were the leaders of the pack. They're the only ones that breed. Now this dominance hierarchy that I mentioned of males and females, there's a lot of tussling around within that hierarchy to maintain the hierarchy, and especially during the breeding season. Every wolf wants to increase its species. Every wolf wants to breed. They all have that the hormones and the biological drive to do that. But it's the alpha males and female that prevents any other wolf from breeding. Now, it has happened where another pair has bred, but it's very unusual, and biologists believe that that is to the best of the pack to only raise one litter of pups. So that's kind of the why is seen from a biological standpoint, but that's the alpha male and female. That's one of the characteristics, is they're the only ones that breed. They determine the territory, they determine the den site. They're really in charge of the pack's activities. This is a denning site up in the Arctic, the Arctic wolves. Denning tends to take place in March and early April, and that's the only time they use a den. So another thing to me that is just fascinating about the wolf and many other wild animals is they don't have a shelter in the middle of the winter when I'm sitting around a fireplace reading a good book, drinking some hot cocoa. All these wild animals, the wolf in particular, they don't go into a den to stay warm. They're under a spruce tree with their tail curled up around their nose. But they have the pups in early April. The female's the only one that ever goes in the den to have the pups. They're born without their eyes open, without any teeth. They're totally dependent on the female and her milk. And about 10 days after they've been born, they come out to the mouth of the den, the opening of the den. Their eyes are starting to open and got their little teeth, and they're cute as a dickens. They weigh about a pound at birth. And the rest of the pack at that time starts to care for the pups. The pups are going to spend the whole summer in one or two areas that are called rendezvous or nursery sites. And they're generally near water. They're generally a meadowy, grassy type area. And they're playing around, learning everything they need to learn about being wolves. Interesting here, and I'll show you later in some slides of adult wolves, they're doing this dominance thing at a very young age. And it within the even the wolf pups, biologists believe there's a dominance hierarchy within just a litter of pups. And one is going to become stronger because it's going to be more aggressive, it's going to get more food. And here they're doing a very typical wolf thing where the dominant animal has his tail up and the submissive animal is kind of rolled over, exposing his belly. They do that throughout their lives in their interactions with each other. As I said, the whole pack is going to care for the young all summer long. And here, perhaps an older brother or sister, but definitely an older pack member, has gone out to a hunt, has either caught himself a snowshoe hare or has helped in taking down a muskox. These, again, are the Arctic wolves. And comes back to the pups. The pups immediately run to greet any animal that any of the other wolf pack members that comes into their nursery site because they know they might be carrying food. And what happens is they greet the animal by licking at its jaw, licking wildly at its jaw. And wolves as adults will still do that with each other as a greeting, lick their jaws. And dogs will jump up on you and try and lick your face. They believe that that's a behavior carried back from this survival mechanism in wolves. So anyway, the licking of the face, of the jaw, stimulates the adult to regurgitate the food that they've partially chewed up. Which sounds very unappetizing, I know, to us as people. We tend to prefer blenders, but the wolves don't have that option. So the kids, I do this a lot with kids, and they really have a hard time with this. I ask them, well, didn't your mother do that with your baby food? And they have a hard time. Anyway, again, many things in the wild scheme of things are pretty uncivilized to us, but they work. They work for survival. So that is how they get their food, and certainly as they get older, they're able to, the adult will bring back the dead hare or whatever, and they'll start eating it like that. But that's when they're youngins, that's how it works. They grow really fast. They truly only have the summer to gain their adult weight, because once winter hits, because they're in the northern hemisphere, winters tend to be at least a little bit severe everywhere where they live. They're going to gain several pounds a week. They even have to learn how to howl. So they practice their howls. And when you listen to, I don't know how many of you have had the privilege to be able to hear a wolf pack howl. I'm real fortunate that I have been in the wild and howled for wolves and had them respond. But you can really tell the pups. They sound like adolescents, you know, just getting their voices to work for them. So it's pretty cute. This is a pup then, born in early April. This is shot taken in October. So now he weighs 60 pounds. So from 1 to 60 pounds over the summer is quite an increase in body weight. And again, that's for survival, because they're not going to hang around a nursery site in the middle of the winter. There just isn't enough food. They need to start traveling throughout their territory to find their food. Now, a wolf has a decision to make in its first couple years of life. It has to decide whether it wants to hang out with the pack and be bossed around by mom and dad and never get a chance to breed, or if he wants to take off and make it on his own. It's a life or death decision. Many of the wolves that disperse, and that's what they're called when they leave, a disperser, die. Very, very many of them die. I should mention, actually, 50% of the pups on average will die every year before their first year too. So the pack size doesn't keep increasing. I didn't mention that either. The pack size anywhere from 2, which would be just the alpha pair, to 15 wolves or even more. In the northern Minnesota where we study them, average size is probably 7 or 8 wolves. So obviously there is some death happening each year, some mortality happening each year. So the disperser, what he has to, he or she, both males and females disperse, the disperser needs to find a territory not occupied by another wolf pack, needs to find a mate, and that territory needs to have a food supply. So three real key things need to happen for a new pack to begin, and that would be how a new pack would start. Territories vary, dependent really totally on the prey that is available there. A smaller territory with a lot of prey could support a large pack, but a small territory with very little prey is going to support a smaller pack, obviously. So that's how it works. This is just a diagram of some territories up in the study area near Ely, Minnesota. And I put this on mainly because one of the problems the dispersing wolves have in finding their own territory is if they start heading through another wolf's territory, they can be killed. A wolf pack will attack a wolf not from their pack if it's crossing into their territory, especially if they're stressed by a limited food supply or any other stress that might be happening within the pack. So it's not safe to be traveling straight through any other territory if you're a wolf that does not belong to that pack. Now, something that completely contradicts that, and that's one of the wonderful things about wildlife biology, is the animals truly do know more than the biologists, and we're never going to be able to figure everything out that they're doing. But a pack, if it loses one of its alpha pairs, they will recruit an animal from outside their territory, and that's thought. They won't always do that. Sometimes it comes from within the hierarchy, within the pack, but they at times will recruit another animal, probably to help the genetics and to avoid so much inbreeding. Wolves don't want to spend any energy that they don't need to spend. They don't want to be killing other wolves that are traveling through their territory all the time. I shouldn't say they don't want, but that isn't advantageous for their life, for their energy expenditures, all that stuff. So they're constantly communicating to their own pack and to other wolf packs all kinds of things, one of which is, here is our territory, the rest of you guys stay out. They communicate to bring the pack members together. Often the pack is scattered throughout their territory. They could be 15, 20 miles away from each other. So they're howling to bring the pack together or to just locate the other pack members. They're howling if there's a kill. So there's a lot of communication, and each wolf howls differently than another wolf would. They truly know the howls of their own pack members. Another method of communication that is especially important in defining territory is scent marking. The behavior that dogs have all over your garden flowers, you know, the scent marking all around the shrubbery and such. Well, wolves are doing that around the boundaries of their territory. They're scent marking all the trees, big clumps of snow, whatever. And that's very helpful for those dispersing wolves because they know just by using their incredible sense of smell whose territory they're coming too close to. And so they have to either go right on those borders, because that's kind of a no man's land, no wolf's land, or really skirt way around the other territories of other wolves. You think you have problems. Imagine these poor wolves. Another form of communication that is happening all the time within the pack, and this is what is maintaining these dominance hierarchies within both the males and the females, is this body language, very physical body language that they're interacting with each other. The dominant animal is going to have the upper jaw over the submissive one, basically. And you can tell the submissive one is about to roll over. The dominant one has the hackles up on his back. The tail is up a little higher. Wolves do not hold their tail up all the time like many breeds of dogs do. They often are going to have the tail down pretty low, but the dominant animal is going to have it raised higher than another. They'll, without even touching each other, they're interacting with each other, and just, again, the body language is signaling who is the dominant, who is the submissive wolf to maintain this hierarchy. The wolf as predator is, as I mentioned, one of the reasons that some people have a hard time with wolves is because they are a predator and they do take down the large animals and small animals. The Arctic hare is one of the food of the Arctic wolves, as are the musk oxen. This is why a wolf lives in a pack. To take down one of these musk oxen is an incredible feat, but working together in a pack, they're able to do it. But even in a pack, they tend not to get the bulls and the cows but the calves or any animals showing any kind of a weakness. Some other common food here, of course, it would be the mule deer, and mountain goats would be another one here. Beavers also. Rabbits, small rodents, squirrels, those kinds of things are part of their diet, but really it's the large ungulates that are the largest part of the diet. The mouse, if you've ever read or seen the movie Never Cry Wolf, you'd be led to believe that wolves survive on mice. Dr. Meech doesn't believe this is very accurate, and his opinion comes from the facts that wolves need 10 pounds of food a day on average to survive, 6 to 10 pounds depending on if it's a breeding animal and such. So eating a mouse would be like eating a potato chip a day for us. It just wouldn't do it, and all the energy to catch all those mice, and it's just biologically it's not thought to be true. I mean, if it's there, they'll eat one, and the pups might play with them, but it's not a main part of their diet, as thought by Dr. Meech. Wolves are always hunting. They're an animal that could go days without food because they haven't found any, or the opportunity hasn't presented itself. So they're always moving, always hunting. And they hunt by their nose. They have an incredible sense of smell, and it's been shown that they can smell their prey a mile and a half away. They can pick up the scent, which is incredible. Their sense of smell is probably at least 10 times greater than ours. And just looking at there, and I'll show you the skull, just the space in their nose for all the sensing organs is just so much more pronounced than ours. So they're smelling by their nose. They can travel for hours and hours and hours and hours and hours at a steady pace of like 5 miles an hour, just a trot, a real comfortable trot, and they're traveling and traveling and traveling throughout the territory. There's been one wolf that was documented to disperse 350 miles to start a new pack. So they really are animals that can travel. But they also have speed. They can have been clocked to run at about 45 miles an hour over a short distance. That's fast. That is so fast. I sit in my car going 45 and I look along and imagine a wolf keeping up with me, and just, not over a long distance, but just that they can do that even over a short distance is just power. They are just muscle and power. They, when they take down their prey, they're going to eventually eat pretty much everything. They've been known to eat the hair of the animal. The one thing they tend not to eat is the stomach, because the animals they're eating are herbivores. They're eating plants, and wolves don't eat plants, so they're not interested in that. But everything else they're eating. And they tend to eat together fairly in a fairly friendly manner, unless they're stressed by a food shortage. Then they tend to tussle, and the more dominant animals are going to get more meat. They'll tear off a chunk of meat and head off a ways away and eat it. They've been known to eat 20 pounds of meat at one time. 20 pounds of meat over maybe a 4 or 5 hour period. That'd be like us eating the meat out of 80 quarter pounders. I'll give you a day to do it, but you're still gonna do it. I mean, obviously it'd be impossible. There's no way. I don't know that I'd wanna even try myself, but that we were able to do that. But again, they're adapted to gorge like this on meat, and then they may have a week before they have a really good meal again. They need to drink a lot of water with this kind of a, you know, meat diet like that, or they get a poisoning in their system if they don't drink a lot of water. But they're able to do that. And then they lay around for quite a while and digest. If you imagine 20 pounds of food in your stomach. This slide is a real important one. It's one that some people have a real hard time looking at, but it's the whole attitude of the predator killing the prey and coming upon this and thinking, oh, what a waste, this poor animal and this and that. But to look at it and see a part of the cycle of nature, and to realize that this carcass is going to be food for many, many critters in the forest, from the minks and the weasels to the birds to the mice gnawing on the bones to get their calcium and minerals. It's just a a real integral part of the whole cycle of life, and eventually it's going to completely decompose, fertilize the earth, new grass is going to grow, more deer are going to feed there, more wolf will kill that deer, and on and on and on, the cycle of nature, that nothing is bad, but all is a very integral and important part of the whole cycle of life. Another thing, when talking about wolf, predator and prey relationships, that most people don't realize is that often the wolf does not get the meal he's going after, especially with these large ungulates. Take the moose, for example. In one study, out of 16 moose that were approached by the wolves, only one was killed and eaten. So 16 moose that the wolf had good intention to try and eat, only one was taken. The moose, especially, but as well as the deer as well, actually can kill the wolves with their hooves, with their antlers, in the case of a bull moose. So it's not like the wolf is coming over and that animal is going to get eaten at all. If it's a strong, healthy animal, chances are it's going to not be approached and not be attacked. There, it's been witnessed where a wolf and a moose just stare each other down, and the moose holds its ground, and the wolf, it's like the wolf is saying, just wanted to see how you were today, and turns around and leaves, kind of a deal. Just no intention of following through, because it's not a safe situation for the moose. Also in the studies, these are with deer jaws here, we're showing that the average age of the deer population is 3.5 years. The older deer, 5.5-year-olds, are the ones that are most often being killed. So through that research, it is said that wolf tend to get the older animals in the herd. Also, some of the deer that are gotten have arthritic sores and lumps. They are not as healthy. They're not able to move away as fast. Those are the animals that are going to fall prey to the wolf. Now, that's not to say, I'll be the first one to say that if a wolf pack can get the nicest buck you've ever seen with the biggest rack and just the prime animal of the herd, if he can get that through deep snow conditions or whatever situation that would predispose the wolf to be able to take that animal, he'd take it in a minute. They're not, you know, they haven't read the textbooks that they're only supposed to take the weak and the lame, you know, and the old. They're going to take whatever they can get. But just looking at it logically, whatever's the easiest to get is what they're going to get more of. So that's where that's coming from. Just a herd of caribou. Wolves actually travel with the caribou herds, and the caribou pay them little mind oftentimes because there's so many caribou in the herd, and it's the caribou that are lagging behind are the ones that are actually gotten. The black belt caribou never get taken, then, as I mentioned. This is to help remember that concept. Another problem as far as people's attitudes towards wolves, and if you're a farmer or a rancher, you can have animals taken by wolves if you're living in a wolf territory. In Minnesota, where most of the research has been done with this interaction with farmers and wolves and the livestock and such, one out of every 1,200 farms in wolf territory was affected. One out of every 1,200. Very small percentage. But if you are that one farmer, you have a very loud voice and you're angry, and that's your livelihood, and certainly there's an issue there. What Minnesota does is pay the rancher a certain amount of money to compensate for the livestock loss, and also they send their government personnel, Department of Agriculture, sends a trapper there to actually kill the wolves that did that, even though they're protected. That is something that they somehow were able to write in. They delisted the wolves from endangered to threatened in Minnesota, which is probably one of the reasons they can do that. But they are trying to do a couple of things: get rid of the problem wolves, as well as appease the farmers so the farmers don't start killing the wolves themselves. So that's happening there, and that's what they're suggesting for the Yellowstone ecosystem also, is to compensate the ranchers and farmers that have problems, and to potentially do some sort of control method for the wolves that are causing the problems. Oops, that's backward. I just put that in this morning. Just showing you that the cattle is the largest percentage of animals that are taken, but sheep, turkey, dogs. Wolves do not like dogs. They kill them on a regular basis when they overlap their territories. This is just a research plane where all the research that all this information has come from, mainly in the northern Minnesota area. This is Dr. Dave Meach. radio telemetry is what we're using to follow the wolves in Minnesota and in many other areas, Alaska as well. This is just the antenna that will pick up the signal, and the several wolves in each pack have a radio collar on that transmits the signal. So we're able to follow the packs, count the number of wolves, look at their movements and such. We also work on the ground with the wolves. We have a new collar that actually has a computer on it. We can send the computer a signal to fire darts, tranquilizing darts located on the collar, so we can tranquilize the wolf from miles away. And then we hike in through bogs and swamps and forests and such, get real wet and really hot and sweaty, and get to the wolves, and then we do research on the wolves. This particular wolf was taken down in October. She was about 60 pounds. And what we're doing with her during that time of the studies, we're taking quite a few blood samples and trying to determine if there's a hormonal relationship, increase in hormones, that triggers some wolves to disperse and some wolves not. So why do wolves disperse? What causes some to disperse and some not to? Because they certainly all don't. That was one of the questions that was being asked during that study. This is just showing the computer collar in that big box is a computer. The computer also can send us signals telling us if the wolf is moving or not. There's a little mercury-filled like switch, and every time it tilts, it registers on the computer. So it's really an aid to research, wolf research. The International Wolf Center, if you're ever in Minnesota, northern Minnesota, is an incredible place to visit. They have a captive wolf pack, and it's probably the easiest place to actually go out and view wolves in the entire lower 48 states, because you can actually see them, you can haul for them, and they will answer at least one out of three times, which is pretty good odds, and it's pretty darn exciting to get them to actually respond.
What town is that in?
Ely, Minnesota, about 5 hours north of Minneapolis, St. Paul. And you can actually fly in. It's very, very common. They have wolf weekends, they call them, and they take people out to wolf territory. They see the kills. You fly the planes over. It's all wilderness lake country. It's, like I said, 2 million acres of wilderness. You're flying over, seeing the packs, and howling for them at night, and listening to lectures from the wolf biologists during the day. And it's just a fascinating wilderness experience if you have the time and can get to that area. Seeing wolf tracks is probably the closest most people will come to seeing wolves at all, but hopefully there'll be more places where we can actually see the tracks. And I just think it'd be the greatest blessing in the world to actually see a wolf in the wild. I've seen them, they've crossed in front of my car when I've been on the roads up in the Boundary Waters area. And of course, when I'm with the biologist studying them and taking them down, I think that's cheating though, when they're already tranquilized, to see them. Kind of like to see them in a little more wild situation. The bottom line for wolves is wilderness. The only way we're going to have and sustain a wolf population is to have wilderness areas. So I encourage anyone that I ever talk with to do all you can in your power to maintain and protect and promote habitat preservation and wilderness. And conservation too is another thing. It truly is the case that if you turn off a light switch and conserve water, you're helping the wolf. Because the fewer energy resources that we need to get at, the less we have to take away habitat, the more the wolves and all the other critters are going to have a place to live. So any conservation effort really helps in the case of the wolf. And if you really are inclined to, the more our politicians know that if it is the case, if you are concerned with having wolves in out west or wherever in the national parks, to write a letter really can make a difference too. So hopefully wolves will be something that we'll have for a long time. A quote that I kind of changed a little bit from a person named Tanaka Skozo goes, "The care of wolves is not a question of wolves, but of the human heart." And I'd like to close with a quote by Aldo Leopold, since I opened with his reading. And he wrote, "Like winds and sunsets, wild things have been taken for granted until progress has begun to do away with them. Now we face the question of whether a higher standard of living is worth its cost in things natural, wild, and free." And I didn't take the pictures. Got to be clear about that. We have to end in a minute here. I have artifacts to show you. I'm going to play the howling tape as we dismiss here. If someone would like to hit the lights, and I can, or you can try and flick off the slide projector there. And I'll hang around to answer questions here, too. I'm sorry, I went right to the time. I meant to have time for all these questions. And I do want to at least make you aware, if you'd like to come see the radio collar, an old one, not a computerized one. And then I think it's real cool to look at the skull and check out.